This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Daniel. Now here's Pastor Sandy in Daniel chapter 11 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
When I was 10 years old, my dad put a basketball hoop up in our backyard. I love basketball. And day after day, I would be out in the backyard dribbling and shooting and pounding the ball under that basketball hoop. Of course, this caused a problem for my dad. He liked a nice lawn. And the constant pounding of sneakers and basketballs made it impossible for him to grow any grass underneath that basketball goal. It looked sort of like this. In fact, the last time I was by the old house, that bare spot was still there. Well, in Daniel chapter 11, the spotlight is also on the Father's backyard. I mean, God the Father's backyard. And where might that be? How about the land called Israel? You see, it's not the Jews who own the land. It's not the Arabs who own it either. All the earth belongs to God. And throughout the Bible, the Lord exercises a special claim on the land of Israel. He has leased it to the Jews, but it belongs to him. And in Daniel chapter 11, for 150 years, the kings of Syria and the kings of Egypt pound the ground in the Father's backyard. Chapter 11 begins. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Now, these are the words of the heavenly messenger who's been dispatched to communicate to Daniel the future of God's people Israel. The Jews, remember, had spent 70 years in Babylon in captivity. Daniel knew that a new day was dawning for his people, for Israel. But what would the future hold? What would it bring? Well, in chapter 11, God gives to Daniel a panoramic view of what's ahead for Israel over the next 280 years, and even into the end times. Daniel's vision is so exact that we read it as history. Just remember, it's not history, it's prophecy. Written by Daniel in 530 BC, fulfilled not until several hundred years later. These predictions all came true before the fact and prove conclusively that the Bible is of supernatural origin. Well, verse 2 tells us, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." Now, after Cyrus and his co-regent Darius, three more Persian kings came to power. First was Cyrus's son, a man named Cambyses. He reigned from 530 to 522 BC. Second was a man that we now call Pseudo-Smerdis, who reigned in 522 BC. Pseudo kind of tips off what's going on here. He was actually an imposter who gained access to the royal household because he somehow looked like Cambyses' son. Well, once he invaded the royal court, he was eventually able to steal the throne. This fake prince lasted for 6 months before he was murdered. The third king was named Darius Hystaspes, who reigned from 521 to 486. And this fourth king, referred to here as far richer than them all, was a king known to secular history as Xerxes and to biblical history as Ahasuerus. Now, this Ahasuerus, or this Xerxes, was the Persian king who co-starred in the story of Esther, if you're familiar with that book. He was an egomaniac who set out to conquer Greece. Here we're told he stirred up all against the realm of Greece. Xerxes allied himself with the Phoenician city of Carthage, which also attacked Greek colonies in Sicily and in Italy. To invade Greece, Xerxes mounted this large army. In fact, it was the largest army probably the world has ever seen. Some 3 million men. He took 4 years to train his army. And then in just 7 days, He marched his army across the Hellespont on specially built barges. His invasion, though, of Greece proved to be the Persian Waterloo. Despite his formidable army, he was crushed soundly by the Greeks, and he was sent back to Persia limping. Xerxes went on to reign from 485 to 465, and six other Persian kings followed. Xerxes' defeat, though, marked the beginning of the end for the Persian Empire. Well, Daniel goes on, "Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." And who is this mighty king? None other than Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, in 337 BC, at the tender age of 19 years old, became the general of the Greek army. And in just 10 short years, he conquered the whole known world. Legend has it that at the age of 33, he laid on his bed and he cried, for there were no more worlds for him to conquer. Verse 4 tells us, "And when he had arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion," which would have been according to custom, "with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these." Now it's said that just before Alexander the Great died, he was asked to name his successor. He whispered these words, "Give it to the strong." Oh boy. Little did he know what his survival of the fittest approach would mean to his own family. It actually involved the death of his own royal family. Within 15 years after his death, the entire family of Alexander had been murdered by each other, all vying for the throne. Alexander did have two sons. One was illegitimate and one was born after his death. Neither of his sons was recognized as his rightful heir. His half-brother, Philip, did reign for 6 years before he too was murdered. The kingdom was eventually divided among his four generals, which was an amazing fulfillment of Daniel 11, verse 4. For even though it was contrary to Oriental custom, Alexander's reign was handed down, and I quote, "not among his posterity." Now from verses 5 through 20, the focus now of the prophecy becomes the two Greek generals and their successors who lived just north and south of Israel. The Seleucids took Syria. The general Seleucid and his heirs are now identified in the coming verses as the kings of the north. Ptolemy ruled Egypt. He and his successors now become the kings of the south. And remember, in between these two Greek empires is the land of Israel, the father's backyard. And for a century and a half, these Greek kings in Syria and Egypt alternately attack each other and trample down the father's backyard. They pound the ground. They toss around God's people, the Jews. And here Daniel records these events 4 centuries in advance. Remember the Three Stooges? Mo, Larry, and Curly. You remember those guys. Well, Mo and Larry were always taking out their frustrations on Curly. He was the brunt of their angst. Well, picture Syria and Egypt as sort of Mo and Larry. And in between, getting bonked on his head constantly, is Curly, the Jews. 6 Syrian wars occur in the father's backyard. And it's both Syria and Egypt taking out their frustrations on the Jews. Heard the other day that a cable station ran 12 straight hours of the Three Stooges. Well, the bonking in chapter 11 goes on for approximately 150 years. Verse 5. "Now also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." This was Ptolemy I, who reigned from 323 to 285. His prince was a fellow general who originally fought by his side in the Greek army, Seleucus Nicator, who then took over the lands in the north. This Seleucid became his rival, stole the northern portion of Ptolemy's kingdom, and established his own throne. It was this betrayal that became the root of the bitter rivalry that lasted for centuries between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. In fact, the Seleucid dynasty in its capital of Antioch, that'll be important because a lot of these kings get named Antiochus after the capital, became the largest of all four Greek empires. At one point, it had more territory than the other three combined. It goes on, and at the end of some years, they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now the Egyptian son, Ptolemy II, he feared his northern neighbor, so he established a peace treaty with Syria. In ancient times and in Oriental cultures, the signing of a treaty was affected by the giving of a daughter in marriage. This made the two rival kings one family, became less likely to kill each other. Ptolemy II, he gave his daughter Berenice to Antiochus II, king of the north. But in order to take her to be his wife, Antiochus, he had a problem. He already had a wife. And so he had to divorce his wife at the time, a woman named Laodice. Yet Antiochus, the problem is, he didn't like his Egyptian princess. And he had to wait until his father-in-law died off. When he did, he annulled the marriage to Berenice, and he took back Laodice. That sets up the next verse. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, that was Berenice, and neither he, Antiochus, nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. It seems that Antiochus' jilted wife, Laodice, was not a very forgiving gal. She didn't like being jilted. As the old saying goes, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And in retaliation for being dumped, she poisoned both Antiochus and Berenice. Verse 7. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Ptolemy III was Berenice's Egyptian brother. And when he heard what had happened to his sister, he invaded Syria seeking revenge. He executed Laodice, he captured the capital of Seleucia, and he carried off tremendous treasure. We know from secular sources he took back to Egypt 4,000 talents of gold, 40,000 talents of silver. Remember, a talent was about 75 to 100 pounds. And 2,500 gold idols. Verse 9. Also, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. After the invasion of Ptolemy III, peace lasted for 10 years until Seleucus II tried to invade Egypt. His mission was flawed from the very beginning. His army was slaughtered. His navy was lost at sea. He returned home thoroughly vanquished. Now, just to pause for a moment, just to help you understand. In that classic movie, Back to the Future 2, you remember that? Classic. In that classic movie, the evil Biff, he gets his hands on a sports almanac that Marty has brought back from the future. Do any of you remember this? Okay, good. Maybe good. Maybe you ought to upgrade your movies. But anyway. In the movie, he finds, and in the sports almanac, he finds the scores of all the major sporting events over the next 50 years. And you remember what he does? He uses the knowledge to gamble on all those games, and he makes a fortune. Well, if you had been living around the year 200 B.C., and if you were a betting person and you possessed a copy of the book of Daniel, you too could have made a fortune. For Daniel 11 is recording the scores in advance, predicting the outcomes of 150 years of Syrian and Egyptian contests. It's amazing. Verse 10, back to the record. However, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. The two sons of Seleucus II were Seleucus III and Antiochus III. Or as Antiochus was called, Antiochus Magnus, which means Antiochus the Great. Both these sons were men of war. And one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. This was Antiochus the Great. He attacked the Roman garrison of Ptolemy III, which he had placed to control the conquered areas of Seleucid. Antiochus' assault made Ptolemy IV, the new king of Egypt, extremely angry. And so the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. And this is the biblical record of one of the greatest battles in ancient history. Antiochus III mounted an army of 75,000 troops. Ptolemy countered with a formidable army of his own, 73,000 men, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants, war elephants no less. The Battle of Raphia was the last major war in history to use elephants in combat. Antiochus, he had the larger Indian elephants. Ptolemy had the smaller African elephants. But in the end, Ptolemy's army had more in their trunk than Antiochus. And at Raphia in 217 BC, Syria fell to Egypt. The famous war, also known as the Battle of Gaza, was one of the largest battles in the ancient world. Verse 12 tells us, when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. Now, much of the battle between Antiochus the Great and Ptolemy IV was fought in the father's backyard in Israel. Again, the Jews were in the midst of this Grecian tug of war. History tells us that Ptolemy's victory at Raphia inflated his ego, so much so that on his way back to Egypt, he decided to stop off at the temple in Jerusalem and desecrate it, mock it, blaspheme it. He was about to enter the Holy of Holies when suddenly, miraculously, he was struck down to the ground speechless and couldn't proceed. I imagine God had had enough of this guy. Embarrassed over being incapacitated upon his return to Egypt, he had 40,000 Jews slaughtered. That's what Daniel predicted, casting down tens of thousands. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and more equipment. In other words, Antiochus wouldn't give up. Now in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. Antiochus the Great, he refused to give up. 14 years after the Battle of Raphia, he invaded Egypt again, this time, though, with great success. In fact, he conquered most of Egypt. Ptolemy IV had died, and his son Ptolemy V came to power when he was just 4 years old. The confusing political situation that produced and the lack of leadership made it very easy for Antiochus. We're also told, but he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. Remember, the glorious land is a biblical idiom for Israel, for God's land. So en route to invading Egypt, this Antiochus the Great, he swept through the Jews. Now he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or before him. At the time, Egypt had started courting an alliance with a rising power further north in the Mediterranean, the Romans. Rome was now fresh off of victory over Hannibal and Carthage, the Second Punic War. Egypt had gone to Rome to seek help against Syria. Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great, he saw the growing ties between Egypt and Rome, and so he decided to strike a peace treaty with Egypt. Remember what happens when you strike a peace treaty? You give him your daughter. And so Antiochus gave his daughter in marriage to Ptolemy, hoping, though, that she would spy for him, that she would work in his interests. A marriage was arranged between the 12-year-old Ptolemy Epiphanes and Antiochus the Great's daughter, a very famous 11-year-old girl named Cleopatra. Cleopatra. Now, Antiochus' plan failed. Cleopatra fell in love with her Egyptian husband, and she ended up defending Egypt and going to bat for the Egyptians and for the Ptolemy. And this was just as Daniel predicted. Just read it in your Bible. It's amazing. He says, after this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against him to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Antiochus the Great, he sought to expand his kingdom northward into Asia Minor. But in 190 BC, he was greeted by the Roman general Scipio and his 80,000-man army. And at the Battle of Magnesia, Seleucia suffered a crushing defeat. Antiochus' younger son was carried off to Rome. That's an important note. This was to ensure his father's good behavior. And Antiochus the Great returned to Syria not so great. The Romans levied heavy taxes upon him. In fact, it forced him to spend the rest of his life robbing temples and raising funds to pay off the Romans. This was the practice that eventually got him killed, as we'll see in verse 20. For there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. Now, Antiochus the Great's son, Seleucus IV, he succeeded his father. And he sent his IRS, his internal revenue chief, Heliodorus, to Judah to squeeze taxes out of the Jews. Can you imagine a government wanting to squeeze taxes out of its people? Imagine that. Well, Heliodorus, he ended up returning to Antioch, and he poisoned the king, Seleucus. He took the throne for himself. And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Here's a vile, here's a crafty, here's a deceptive king. Remember, Antiochus the Great, he had a son. Where was he? He was living in Rome. His name was Antiochus the Fourth. Don't you love the creative ways these guys give names to their kids? Sandy the Second, Sandy the Third, Sandy the Fourth. Well, when this Antiochus the Fourth heard about his brother's death and Heliodorus' claim to the throne, he hatched a plot. He was not the rightful heir to the throne. As Daniel says, he had not been given the honor of royalty. The heir was the son of Seleucus the Fourth, a man named Demetrius. But it was while Demetrius was away that Antiochus the Fourth had Heliodorus put to death. And through his flatteries, he wooed the Syrians. He took the throne for himself. Just as Daniel said, not in anger or in battle, but through flatteries, through deception. With his slick dealings, with his lying tongue, this Antiochus secured the help of influential friends in Rome and in Pergamum. And he took the throne of Syria. Literally, as Daniel had predicted, he came to power peaceably by intrigue.
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio. You've been listening to our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. We're currently going through the book of Daniel. Daniel can be regarded as the revelation of the Old Testament because it contains visions and prophecies regarding the end times. From visions of strange creatures to prophecies of the Antichrist, this book is often studied hand in hand with the book of Revelation to inform our understanding of the end times. When studying end times prophecies, it's easy to focus too much on the sensational details and miss out on the big picture. The point that we can't miss is that God is in control of everything. He's already told us the ending. God wins, and His kingdom will be the only one left standing. If you have any questions about the message you just heard, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. You can also find more information on our website, sandyadams.org. While you're there, you can listen to our other teachings, or you can also download our mobile app to listen to these messages wherever you are. Join us again next time as Pastor Sandy continues to teach through the book of Daniel on Sandy Adams Radio.